Hello, thank you very much for listening to How to Be Hopeful. I'm Bernadette Russell. This is my podcast all about hope. It's all about where you might find hope and how you can keep hold of it once you've found it. And I'm super excited to reconnect with an old friend from back in the olden days, as we were just talking about, practically on the eve of the US election, which we'll be talking about amongst other super interesting things. Hello, Nafisa.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's so lovely to see you.
Yes.
I just wanted to, I want to speak to you about all of your amazing work as well, but I wanted to sort of have a chat and kind of get a personal response from an American friend about this week's elections, as I'm sure you know. I don't know whether this is annoying for you, but I don't know whether it is or not, but we feel very attached to the election. It feels like, for a lot of UK people, I'm sure for lots of people around the world, it feels like we should be able to vote because it's going to have such an impact. It's a very...
On the world.
Yeah.
I don't know that I can speak for all Americans, but I can definitely speak for myself and say that I don't feel annoyed. It actually, talking about hope, it actually gives me hope that there are many people in other parts of the world that are just as concerned about the state of the U.S. as many of the Americans are.
Yeah.
And we do wish, well, I don't know. I mean, I guess we wish you could vote. I don't know. You know, but that's going towards what a world government, and that will be, I'm sure, 3 or 4 generations down. We've got to meet aliens first.
Yeah, we'll get to the aliens. We'll see if we can contact them for the next episode. It's interesting. There was some conversations on the BBC breakfast this morning about how is that strange that we're so connected, but we are, and it's kind of fascinating. Also, there's a lot of affection for Americans from the UK. Despite this story that I think is sometimes told, I think there's a lot of affection for Americans and American culture, so we felt very connected to it. But first of all, we need to hear about who you are, because nobody will know. So could you talk a little bit about yourself, a bit of background, just so we can understand where you're coming from, so we know who you are, whatever you want to say.
Sure. Goodness. What is it? I grew up in Northern California. That's always the job interview scary question, right? Tell us about yourself.
No, I'm sorry. That's so.
No. I'm just giggling because I have, you know, lots of memories of being a kid and trying to figure out what do I say when they say, tell me about yourself. No, but, so for me, I was born and raised in Northern California, in Palo Alto, California. That's where I'm from. And I was there until I was 18. And then I went to undergraduate school at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. And then I moved to LA to be a big and famous actress, which is where you and I met.
Yeah.
I did not become a big famous actress. I worked on occasion, but I didn't become a big famous actress, which is okay. Well, it was okay. Now I really want to be big and famous. So if you're listening, Spielberg.
Yeah, you better be listening.
That's right. We need to make a phone call. Or Tina Fey, any of those, you know, we'll see. But so as I got older in Los Angeles is a tough place, right, as for an actor, especially for a young woman. And I'm of mixed descent at the time when I was there. So I'm African-American, Haitian, German, and Irish. A lot of people, especially Africans, ask me why I say African-American and not a specific country on the continent. And I do want to be clear that I am a descendant of the slaves of America. So I actually don't know which country my family descended from. So that's why I say the African-American. Anyways, just to be clear on that.
Yeah.
But when I was there in L.A., you know, at the time, it was very... if we can't tell what you are, we don't want to hire you, pretty much, if that makes any sense. Like, we're not sure, are you Latina? Are you Black? Are you Puerto Rican? And so being in that in-between space actually did not help me get work. So, and then the older you get and the, and you haven't been discovered in Los Angeles, the more difficult it becomes to continue to get work. And so I was going to leave the acting world completely. And then I decided, you know what? I still have a career on stage. I grew up doing theater in Palo Alto at the Palo Alto Children's Theater. I think from the age of 10, I was doing stuff. I think maybe, was it when I was 10, I was doing stuff backstage, and then maybe 11, I started on stage because I saw the kids on stage and I was like, I want to do that. So anyways, I thought, well, I can still have a career in theater. And I started auditioning for all this theater and I was getting a lot of callbacks, but no bookings. And I was like, why am I not booking these jobs? And then I realized that according to my resume for the last umpteen years, they didn't know that if I could carry on with a play, you know, for 8 shows a week for 3 months or whatever, like they'd, because I had all this film and television on my resume. So I decided to go to graduate school, where I got my master's in fine arts in classical acting. And that was primarily a focus on, Jacobean and Shakespearean works. That was the primary focus of that degree. And that was in Washington, D.C., and I lived there for a couple of years. And then I did a play with Olympia Dukakis, and she was like, why the hell aren't you living in New York? And I said, because I'm scared. And she was like, that's ridiculous. Move your butt to New York, and if you need help, I'll help you. And I moved to New York, and I've been pretty fortunate. I've been a working actress since I moved to New York. I probably work at least half the year in acting. That's and great. Then the other half of the year I'm doing my survival jobs and stuff. But yeah, it's been pretty phenomenal. And then also when I was doing Shakespeare, I know that you're going to ask me about my theater company. I started a small theater company. It's really, you know, the theater company is me. I am the theater company. So like, it's very tiny. But I started that while I was in D.C. because I used to go to these opening nights for the Shakespeare plays. So where I trained was with the company called the Shakespeare Theater Company, which is, I think, I could be wrong, but I think it's the largest Shakespeare company in the country. I'm now thinking about Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and I'm not sure I'm not sure who's larger, but the Shakespeare Theater Company, they just won a Tony that year for a regional theater. And so I, you know, those were my, everybody who works on those shows are our teachers. So like the voice teacher, the movement teacher, stage combat teacher, they were actually all professionals with this company. And I would go to these opening nights and I would look around. Now keep in mind, I'm in Washington, D.C., Washington, D.C. used to have the nickname Chocolate City because there were so many black people there.
Yeah.
That's like, they called it Chocolate City.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, many, many moons ago, maybe the 80s and 70s, I don't know. But anyways, it's an incredibly diverse population. And I would go to these opening nights at the Shakespeare Theater Company, and it was, you know, I'd see maybe, talking in a house full of 1,500 people, I'd see maybe 100 people of color. And I'm looking around going, why is this happening? And then, of course, it's partially because what they're seeing on stage is mostly, you know, Caucasian people doing Shakespeare. And there's this understanding that, you know, Shakespeare was white and he wrote in England. Anyways, I feel that I do know that Shakespeare wrote for the royalty to make money, right? He really wrote for the average man. He wrote for the poor people. His jokes were, and not that the brown people in the world are the poor people necessarily, but he wrote for everybody is my point. There's something in all of his plays for everyone. And
I agree. He was interested in the human experience, which is absolutely all of us, right? It's interesting, Nafisa. I'll send you, a little while ago, I interviewed a friend of mine Tash, who had been, or a couple of friends of mine who had been had done a lot of Shakespeare, and in England, from what I've gathered from both of them right now, the casting's a lot more diverse in every possible way you can imagine it to be, in every possible way. And as an audience member, I have to say, seeing it, it's so exciting.
Yes, there's so much more happening.
I want to see somebody signing.
And having so many more experiences coming to the stage. So many more, like,
It's exciting. you get everyone bringing their stuff to the parts, which is really interesting. Absolutely. But it also makes you pay attention. If that doesn't sound old, I find myself paying attention to the story more. Because I'm surprised by who I can see. Does that make I love it anyway?
Yeah, because you're not stuck. It's moving forward with the times, right? And it's like, oh, I haven't seen this before. What's this going to be? Where, you know, there's only so many times you can see Hamlet with the same looking cast.
Yeah.
You know, it's Shakespeare is unique in that way, in that we all know how it ends.
We do.
and if you don't know how it ends, that's okay too. You should be able to sit and experience it with us anew. But like, if you're not bringing something new to the work, why do it? Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of people have asked, well, why didn't you start like African American Shakespeare Company or something like that? And I'm like, because that's not the point. I'm tired of like an all or nothing. It has to be everybody. If we're going to reflect the community, if art's going to reflect the community, then it's got to reflect the community, period. And the only way to bring in audiences from other places and other understandings and experiences is to also put those other understandings and life experiences on the stage.
Yeah.
No, so fantastic. And behind the scenes and in the designer's seats,
yes,
right?
And the directors, you know? And everybody. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it is happening, from what my friends have been telling me anyway, and colleagues, it's happening a lot more here.
Well, in England, y'all are believe it or not, which is such a, like, if you look at it historically, you go, why is that happening? Because, you know, America is titled the melting pot and we've got all of this stuff, you know, and Europe is on the surface is kind of the understanding of you can be here, but you've got to be like us kind of thing. Right. Whereas, I mean, I know it's an old adage, but that's what somebody who hasn't really traveled kind of thinks. But in England, in terms of your Shakespeare, you're miles ahead of your inclusive casting, miles ahead.
Yeah, but it's good. I mean, the thing is, as well, we have a lot of Shakespeare here. We do bang on about him a lot, which is good. But also, I think it's really interesting that the emphasis on the way history is taught at last in the UK is being changed. And
Really?
Yeah, I think that we are making attempts to educate ourselves to fill in the gaps of our own education. I think that's fair to say. Lots of people are doing that. And I think that there's lots of public excavation going on in the UK. Like, I live on the creek in Deptford, and like all ports in Britain, it was a place that slave people came into, as well as spices and visitors and cloth and stolen goods, etc.
Right.
So every port in England, and it's an island, it's full of ports, is full of stories that are being told at last, or are being more widely told at last, So plaques that used to bear the names of monarchs that were guilty of, for example, trading in slaves or exploitation of the poor themselves, are now being replaced by statues of the people who they were oppressed. So there's loads of... I'm not saying it's perfect, Nafisa, at all.
No, but that sounds pretty freaking amazing.
There are... I feel very hopeful about that, and I do reach for hope, but it feels justified that. Anyway, I don't want to...
That was a really long explanation of why I started Classics in Color, but that's, you know, and it
really
is not just Shakespeare.
Story, you know?
Yeah, I named it Classics so I could reach for whatever I decided was a classic because I started it.
It's nice as well, Classics in Color, because it works both ways, because it made me think of like really beautiful Technicolor, you know, like very colourful sets, etc.
Yeah.
So it works both of those ways, so it's very attractive. And something's really, and I loved it when you said it's really me, because I think there's a lot of us that do that, and we say we to stop feeling lonely. I always say that because most of the
I've just decided it's the royal we, you know. Every time I write the we, I'm like, that's the royal we.
Absolutely.
We have started a company.
Yes, we're very busy. No, but it does make you feel less lonely as well, so that's great. And in terms of your classics, I know you do lots of things, but in terms of your classics in colour experience and portfolio, do you have a sort of favourite show or project that you've done thus far?
That we've done thus far. I do want to say really quickly, of course, it is, you know, the people that support the company. There are hundreds of people that have supported the company. I just want to make that clear. And I have several friends that anytime I'm doing a production, you know, everybody throws in their hand. So I just, you know, it's just on the downtime when it's really like just me on an operating day. I just want to make that clear. I could not do it by myself. So... Just yes, my a production that we've only done two full productions, and we've done a couple of readings. So we co-produced a production of the play Proof, which is now officially deemed an American classic, and that kind of just came about organically, and we ended up co-producing it. But then we did our very own full Much Ado About Nothing, which was really, for me, I say this with hope in my eyes, hopefully the last time that I produce and direct and lead all the fundraising, because I actually don't know how I got through that. But it was, what's pretty darn special about that one is, you know, when you're casting. And my whole thing about classics in color is like, I'm not going to just work with the same people all the time. Like, I want to have as open a casting process as I can, as I can afford. And so I think I had 4 days of, I had open submissions, and I had 4 days of auditions, and I put together this really wonderful cast. And what's special to me about it is that, I shouldn't say I said we, because there were my co-producers and we worked together to cast it. But what's really special about it is that several of them are still friends now. Like, you know, you always hope that you'll help create some sort of ensemble or community, right? But sometimes you do a play and a bunch of people get together and then they don't communicate anymore.
Yeah.
And that's fine. That's part of, you know, that's part of life. It's part of arts. It's part of the community. But there are several of them that like have really made friends with each other, and they enjoy each other's company, and they now support each other's shows, and they're all growing as artists. And some of them are probably going to be big and famous way before me. So it's just, that's something for me. So it's not so much the show as it is the community that was created.
That's lovely. Amazing. And you're a spoken word, you're an artist, poet as well, are you not?
Yes, I call myself semi-retired from that.
Okay, we'll come back to that later. So we've gone all over the place, but I love it because it's really lovely to hear. I think it's just really nice to hear who you are and your journey, which you summarised very efficiently. I just wondered if you, just because as you know, I'm sort of considering hope, not in a kind of you know, a sort of Disney way, I suppose, but mm-hmm. to try to sort of dig into hope and to think about how it can be useful for us in these extremely challenging times. My goodness, since you and I first met back in the mm-hmm. olden days, as we were saying, the world's transformed and it's been tough and good as well in some ways. So I just wondered, just to start us off, if there's been anything for you in the last 7 days that has made you hopeful. Now, if there isn't, as I said, you don't have to have a thing. You don't have to have had.
It's the last 7 days. So one thing you don't know, which is interesting, is that it's the first today. So 2 days ago was the 1 year anniversary of my father's passing. And my father was an abstract expressionist. He never finished a painting, right? The painting was only done when it left the studio because he could no longer work on it. But so I And what's been interesting for me, so my father, over his lifetime, he tended towards certain colors, right? So in the 60s and 70s, I would say he was very dark, like he had nails and black and lots of charcoal, some Zen paintings, but it still was ink, black ink. And then growing up, there were a lot of dark blues and a little bit of reds and stuff. Like those are the colors I remember seeing in his studio. But recently, probably in the last 5 years, he had started using a lot of bright colors. He started using white in his paintings that I'd never seen ever. I'd never seen like blank canvas, much less actual white paint. And then the last time I visited him before he went to the hospital for the last time, he had started putting gold on his paintings, like actual,
gold leaf.
Yes, gold leaf, exactly. And he had started adding this gold to his paintings. I'd never seen that before, and it was fascinating to me. But anyway, so I've been kind of, you know, this last week I have been like kind of meditating on his passing and talking to him and letting him know I miss him. And then I was realizing, like, I'm looking around my apartment and I'm like, God, I have all this gold everywhere. This like, it's like gold powder, because I've been really fascinated with the art of kintsugi.
Oh, me too.
And also because I've been breaking stuff. So
perfect combination.
Yeah. So I've been breaking stuff and I'm like, let's kintsugi it and put gold. And then of course, you know, there's the expansion of the idea of the art of kintsugi, which is for humans, if we're broken and we fill that in with gold and we continue that, you know, as a new person whole, you know, in a new whole. And I literally the last couple of days I was like, wow, that gold and my father's gold in his, and it just connected me in a way that I thought was pretty cool. So that's kind of brought me a little hope in a weird way. I don't know if that answers the question.
No, it does. I think kintsugi is a sort of hopeful practice. It's so mm-hmm. beautiful. I've only recently been introduced to it, and I'm so grateful that my friend introduced me. We should probably explain that it's an ancient Japanese craft and art of fixing broken precious ceramics and pottery with gold sort of celebrate the breakage in a way is that, do you think that's an accurate description?
Yes, and to allow it to be something new. So they often, so if they broke a teapot, the teapot would then become a piece of art. It wasn't necessarily still a teapot, right? And that's something I actually haven't quite gotten to yet, because I want to fix it for what it used to be. And I have to recognize when you're using the kintsugi, the idea is that it becomes something new.
Yeah, that's very important, actually. And I'm still deliberating that. So what does that mean? I love the idea that you can apply it to people or to yourself, but I'm mm-hmm. still like, what does that mean? It's really beautiful. I think that's an amazing example. So the next question I was going to ask you, hopefully these are all really big questions, and it's funny because it's quite late for me at night, but hopefully not
too late for you. I know, I'm so sorry.
No, it's nice. I'm just aware that I'm a bit dreamy. It's quite nice. yes, I wondered if you have, I'm really interested in, particularly this week, because the whole Samhain, Halloween, All Saints, that kind of thing, I think mm-hmm. does give us an opportunity, although we don't always take it, to think of people that have gone and to kind of welcome them and to raise a glass, however you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think we've lost that a little bit. We Brits, I mean, have sort of lost that. Some of us have lost that a little bit. But I've been thinking about that a lot and thinking about ancestors. And I've done some really interesting workshops on ancestors. And I wondered if there was anyone that you sort of look to that gives you hope, if hope's flailing for you, that sort of fits into that kind of ancestor, or I mean it might be your dad again, who sounds like an amazing person.
Well, he was a little bit of he was cranky all the time, like I am, so he was just always painting. No, you know what's interesting is I actually talk to the ancestors that I've never met. So like I never met my grandparents on either my mother's or my father's side, and so I often talk to them, and like my grandmother loved monarch butterflies. And this year I was in an area where they breed before they head down to Mexico. And one was a monarch caterpillar was like right in my front yard for many days eating and filling up. It's, you know, and so when I started to see the butterflies, I would talk to my grandmother, Rosalind, and just say, and, you know, hi, Rosalind, thanks for checking on me. So them, but also I have a dear friend who, she left this world way, way too soon. She was 37. She passed away from breast cancer, which, you know, is just, you know, all of the things, but I talk to her a lot. I reach out to her a lot, and I just ask for, I don't know if I ask them questions as much as I thank them for what I feel like is sort of a protection that they, you know, I feel like sometimes I'm being guided, intentionally guided. And so I try to really tune into that as much as I can.
Yeah. That really resonates with me. That thank you, the gratitude thing, and the sometimes feeling connected to people that you don't even know. And for me, that's sometimes nice to extend that idea of ancestors or families, especially if you don't know all of yours, which I don't, to people who feel like family in another way. And I think when I've been trying to, I suppose this is what I'm reaching for, when I've been trying to, when I feel a bit low and despairing, I might think about Millicent Fawcett, you know, the suffragette, or I might think about, you know, Emmeline Pankhurst, or I might think about Martin Luther King, or I might think about people that I think, well, that I know had terrible things happen, much worse than I can imagine happen, but they got up. So I think, I don't know, it feels like a good time of year. You're absolutely right. It should be all times of year, but it's kind of nice to be reminded of it, I think.
Well, when I travel, I have this cute little thing that it's a little concrete thing. I wish, I know we're just audio, so I can't, I would get up and show you, but it's probably, you know, it's about the size, maybe it's about the size of a hand, and it's 3/4. It's meant to hold a little candle, but it's got a little reflective surface at the bottom. And what I've done is I've made kind of a traveling altar or a traveling, memorial type. It's not altar, not memorial. What's the other word? I forget. I can never remember the word that I'm thinking of. But and I've put all of the pictures of the people that have passed that I feel like are looking over me, and also the animals too that I've loved that have also passed.
So and nice. So do you mean a shrine?
Yes, that's the word. Thank you.
Shrine. No, I was thinking as I loved it. Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah.
But what I like, but I decided that I wanted a traveling one because I'm moving. I'm you know, every couple of months for a new job, I'm always in different parts of the states. And so I wanted something that was just always reminded me that they were with me. And so that's a little thing that I've done. So
that's such a good idea. Such a lovely thing to do as well, to take people with you. I think objects help as well. Physical objects really help. They're really comforting. Yeah. We're going to get on to politics in a minute. I'm kind of a little bit fending off because I'm really enjoying talking about shrines and acting. What I wanted to ask you, and there's a little bit of maybe wrong assumption in this question, but I was thinking about back to when we first met, because you may well not know, we worked together on a sort of installation that was kind of performative in Los Angeles, which is where we met.
And with Stans Kaff.
With Stans Kaff from Birmingham. And we had a lovely time. And I had I always think of LA kind of cast a bit of a spell on me because everything changed after that. And that's a big long story. But one of the things that started to happen, and I don't know why, was my sort of activism, which was separate from my work as an artist, started to converge. And from sort of 2008 onwards. And what I found interesting doing these talks with people, when it has been with artists, is that whatever position they started out from when they were artists, however apolitical, for whatever reason that was, they now identify as activists, and that seems to be more and more prevalent because they felt that they have to be, or they've chosen, or they've felt that they've been called. And that my friends who started from an activist place have actually explored creativity. So there's this really interesting thing going on. And I wondered if that's... Do you feel that's happened for you? I mean, if it... I don't want to, like...
No. I giggle because I just, you know, as you speak, I hear friends who basically... I never thought that about my work. Especially with my poetry, I never wrote for a particular cause. So I thought. And then one day, somebody who had been listening to my work for a long time, she just sat down and she said, "You know, your work is all about inclusion, right?" And I was like, "What?" What? She's like, "Yeah, all of your pieces are," and you know, and that was before I had made like a real conscious effort to really focus on anti-racism and inclusion, right? Like that's and anti all the phobias of people of any kind.
Yeah.
Just to clarify. But so I think that it has shown up in my art without me planning it to. And just now that I'm just much more aware of it, right? But I think also these times have really caused or encouraged rather an examination of ways in which I have let either people slide, organizations slide, you know, relationships slide in terms of me saying, you know what, no, that's not okay. Like you can't actually say that in this space. Mm-hmm. And for me, I find that that's where my activism in my artistry is heading, is more just is making sure that I am not part of the problem by being complacent or silent. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
And do you find, because I know amongst my friends here, and I know there's a different sort of funding streams in the US to the UK in terms of theatre, but I know many of my friends feel, of all kinds of artists, are empowered when they start up their own thing, whoever they are, rather than, I suppose, for me, being a jobbing actor requires immense courage, but also a certain, you lose a bit of power and you lose a bit of control, and you maybe, with the best will in the world, sometimes have to put up with things that you shouldn't because you're so powerless. So I have empathy for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I have to say that I did get to an age, I'm not sure when it was, a couple of years ago, where I just decided that if my speaking up meant that I was never going to work with that company again or that I got fired, that I would be okay with that.
Yeah.
And but there are a lot of people who aren't okay with that, right? And rightly so. You know, I honor and respect and totally understand the need. We've got to take care of ourselves and of our families, and you know, we've got to do jobs. I think part of the problem is, especially in the U.S., and I'm not sure about the U.K., but one of the real challenges in the U.S. is that, you know, our organizations weren't built to be inclusive, right? And I don't think that they were built, at least our arts organizations, I don't think that they were built to be intentionally exclusive, but they were not built to be intentionally inclusive.
Yeah.
Which therefore just means that they all hired their friends. They hired their colleagues from schools or whatever. And that's, you know, kind of how it works. You know, you're much more likely to get a big agent and potentially big work if you graduate from Juilliard, than you are if you graduate from the place where I graduated from, even though we both have MFAs. And to be honest, you know, at least my understanding and in-depth knowledge of Shakespeare is greater to those who have studied at Juilliard. So not that that's means one thing or the other, but it's just a it's just another way to examine. That's another challenge that is set forth, right? And for me, why I started Classics in Color, because, you know, I'm not having to go backwards. We're founded on inclusion. I won't even have a rehearsal in a place where somebody, where everybody can get to, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
And that becomes expensive sometimes. There was this one place that was wonderful. But then I said, well, if I cast somebody in a wheelchair, will they be able to use the restroom? They could get to the rehearsal space, but the restroom door was too small to accommodate a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. Like, and you know, it's just those little things that people aren't thinking of. So yeah. It's not that they're being intentionally exclusive, but they're not being intentionally inclusive. And that is the problem, I think. Anyways, sorry, I started to go off on
a rant. No, not at all. I think it's interesting. It's important for us to it feels really appropriate to gently challenge it, because I think if you shout at somebody, they can only defend themselves. But to mm-hmm. kind of say, do you have wheelchair access, et cetera, et cetera? Yeah. Are you going to caption your mm-hmm. shows? Just as a gentle question. Sometimes Absolutely. It's enough to make people go, do you know what? We really need to get a ramp sorted out.
Yeah,
and they haven't been attacked. They've just been gently reminded. It's
right.
I think. Yeah. I mean, from what the interviews I've been doing, it seems like there's lots of hope here. So let's keep that moving. Hope. And so politics. Gosh, sorry. I've got to tell you this because I think you'll find it. I hope you find this funny. Back in 2016, we had the whole Brexit.
Yes.
Thing.
And we felt very connected to you guys at that time, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, I think there was we were really worried and concerned and with everything. I mean, that was the talk of the town. But anyways, please continue.
That's interesting. Yeah. So it's Christmas of 2016 and somebody mm-hmm. bought me a book and it said, the title of the book, excuse my bad language, is 2016, you can fuck off. That was the title of the book. In the right. book, the book was like Brexit ruined Christmas, because there was a, you know, probably not unfair thing about a kind of generational divide for a lot of people where their parents, mm-hmm. for solid reasons, were largely voting to leave. And then you had the younger generations. So it was like nobody's talking, everybody's arguing and throwing Brussels sprouts around. It's horrendous. And then there's also the elections. And
right.
There was a lot of sort of divide, and I looked, it's funny, I looked up, it's still on my shelf, I looked up and I was like, we didn't know what was coming.
Yeah. Yeah.
2016. So I was considering that, yeah. and I think there are parallels between the UK and the US in many ways, but one of them, I feel, is that there's a real concern, is this polarisation of political opinion, a sort of decline in the way that we talk to each other in public discourse is becoming, you know, we seem to not be so good at listening to each other, not be so good at coming to some sort of compromise, or at least trying to learn from each other. And that's a worry. It feels like we need to heal that, which is going to include some really uncomfortable conversations for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned from friends of mine, I voted to remain in the EU. I had friends that voted to leave. And mm-hmm. I started listening, you know, and I got some humbleness and started listening and learning. Yeah. So I think I've strangely got some hope from that, because I think there were the beginnings of people saying, we just keep thinking we're right. We've been thinking we're right and we haven't listened to the people who are suffering and are in pain. So there's a lot of that going on. But you, and of course you had President Trump, and I remember at the time in the lead up, Nafisa, we were all like, there's no way the Republicans are going to pick
him. I agreed. I thought there was no way he was going to get the nomination, no way that he would get elected. And then I remember on election night, I could not stay up. I was so distraught. And I went to sleep. And then in the morning, I texted my mother and I said, did he win? And she was like, yep. And I said, I couldn't believe it. And Bernadette, I had to go to tutor. One of my day jobs is doing private tutoring in New York. And on that day, it just happened that several of my students were of Jewish descent. And they couldn't, we couldn't tutor. They were just crying. They were crying. Like they were so scared for that, for everything, for their livelihood. And these were kids that were just about to graduate high school and go to college. And like, they were just, they were so distraught. But anyway, so I remember very vividly the talk about loss of hope of, and just, disbelief that, that that was even a possibility in our world.
Yeah, it was deeply shocking. It was deeply shocking, I think. Are you sort of lifelong Democrat, if you don't mind me asking? I know not everybody.
Yeah, I would say that I'm a lifelong Democrat. I would say that for the most part, I think I often identify with a lot of liberal, a lot of liberal fights, and I often identify with a lot of the Green Party's fights. But we just, I really feel that in the States, we don't have enough. There isn't enough political clout in either of those parties to really move an agenda forward, and that it has to be a Democrat that is leaning more towards that side that gets that kind of work done.
Do you mean someone in more centrist position? No, the other way. Interesting.
Yeah. Closer to Bernie, but not all the way to Bernie, okay. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So closer to between a Biden and an AOC, right? Mm-hmm. Somewhere in between there. Mm-hmm. That we need somebody that, but also, yeah, I think this is, but the last 4 years for me has, like, I thought that I didn't have really assumptive thoughts about Republicans, right? I didn't really like there up until 2016. I don't think that I really felt, well, I just can't be friends with any Republicans. I had friends who were Republicans and who voted Republicans or who were conservatives and I listened and tried to understand, but I swear in the last 4 years, I don't recognize that party. And what I don't understand is how intelligent people, of whom there are many, that support Trump. I really don't understand what it is they see other than their own pockets.
It feels really important, doesn't it, for all of us, yeah, on the liberal side of things, mm-hmm, to try and understand this. I agree, yeah, with you. I find it baffling, but I'm also concerned that I don't understand. So what I've been, yeah, doing, I'm not saying it's anything, I've just been having one-on-one conversation. I've got Republican friends in the States, and I have friends here who vote for right-wing parties. Just trying to stay, mm-hmm, in the conversation and go, what's going on? In my experience, Nafisa, it has been, as suspected, largely to do with fear, because, mm-hmm, you know, there's no surprise there, is there, that we've yeah, fed this fear narrative so, yeah, efficiently and so voraciously that, of course, we buy it. We're also scared. Yeah. Everybody's scared.
Yeah.
How to sort of deal with that, I don't know. And I keep thinking, because I think about compassionate practice all the time, I always come back to, okay, how can we respond to this compassionately? And then sometimes I'm like, does that mean I have to be compassionate to Trump? Do I have to have compassion to, right, his policies? And I haven't got,
right,
I shouldn't, you know, it's World Kindness Day in a couple of weeks. I haven't got an answer to that. I think sometimes I look at him and I think, you look like someone that's really suffering. You look a bit broken. You don't seem very well. And yet he's still causing so much suffering. It's not my place. It's complex, yeah, isn't it?
It absolutely, I mean, 100%. It's interesting. I made a choice once he got elected to never share any of his information or his name on my social media and all of that kind of stuff. But I also don't participate in the name calling, because I'll tell you what, I didn't like it when they did it to Obama. Mm-hmm. I didn't like it when they did it to First Lady Michelle. And even if I, you know, and Obama had his faults as well. There were things that he made, you know, his immigration policies were some questionables and his drone attacks. And like, there were things that he did that were not perfect. And honestly, I feel like he didn't fight hard enough to get a Supreme Court nominee. That's my personal opinion. People are probably going to come for me after that. But I feel like in that last year of his, I feel like he should have come out of Congress with bloody knuckles, trying to get a Supreme Court person confirmed. But anyways, that's another. But if I don't like it when people do that to my candidate, I'm not going to do that to other people's candidate, whether I feel that way or not, you know. And I am not usually the person that says, you know, if you don't have something nice to say, don't say it. I can be really mean. I used to make people cry on purpose. And so maybe that's part of it. Maybe I'm just trying not to be so mean anymore.
Well, it's also about considering effectiveness, isn't it? Because I've been thinking about, and I do think that being compassionate and staying in a conversation with somebody and listening is more effective. Boy, it's really hard sometimes, and it costs you, and you can't be doing it all the time. And some days you don't want to do that. You want to break a plate over their head like a cartoon mouse.
Right. But, absolutely.
But
yeah.
Do you know Dr. Roxy Manning? Have you heard of
her? No, I've never heard of
her. She's an American academic, a beautiful woman, and she teaches nonviolent communication. She's just been a really big influence on me, and I'm kind of like a fangirl of her. Check her out, Dr. Roxy Manning.
Okay.
But she talks a lot. She's basically instructing us how to better have conversations with each other, have conflict resolutions whilst protecting yourself as well. So, not that I'm ever going to be in a position where I'm going to have a conversation with President Trump, but the same as you, I'm like, do you know what? I'm not posting that. I'm not calling him names. I'm not posting that. I'm going to actually praise and lift up the people who are
working, of
which there is lots in America. Wow, so much going on.
Yeah.
So do you, how are you feeling at the moment? What's your feeling about the election? And I don't know if you know it, but during the Olympics, we had this thing where this octopus, I'm not comparing you to an octopus, but this octopus had to choose which team, I think it might be the football, we had to choose which team, and I was like, poor Nafisa, I can't get her, I'm going to put this out just before the election, making her like the magic octopus.
Oh, goodness. I wish I was like, you know, the groundhog that comes up on Groundhog's Day in the States and decides, you know, sees the shadow or doesn't. Yeah. I wish I could see a shadow or, you know, I honestly have lots of hope. But I also have lots of reality check where it's completely possible that Trump, you know, people are very upset about Amy. I don't even know her last name, Judge Amy, being confirmed on the Supreme Court. And I'm equally upset about that. However, the truth is that he could get reelected in a couple days and he would have been able to appoint her anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like that's... Yes, it would. Yes, and is really trying to be my life. The improvisation rule of yes and. I honestly have no idea. Yes, I'm just as scared as everybody. I have all the fear in the world. I'm horrified at the thought of another 4 years of Trump. And I recognize that I have done what I have the power to do, which is vote. And in the next 4 years, no matter who wins, I have to do more with the powers that I have, right? I have to continue to activate my arts. I have to continue to show up and call people on their shit. I have to call myself on my shit. Like, I gotta really call myself on my shit. And I have to show up and listen, and I have to show up to learn no matter what, there's going to be a lot of work to do. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's just going to be very disheartening if it goes one way. But I still, even if Biden gets elected, I still think there's going to be a crap ton of work to do. Like, there's going to be just as many unhappy people as if Trump got elected.
Yeah.
Like, if that's, which is, that's part, that's our problem right now. How did we get to this place? And if we're so different, how do we move forward together? Like, we're not going to beat coronavirus if we can't move forward together. My goodness gracious.
There's so much healing to do, isn't there? The same in the UK as in the US, that feels like we mustn't forget, as you just said, whoever wins, there's still going to be healing. There's still going to be hurt to do. There's a wonderful artist. He produced a series of videos for Reasons to be Cheerful, where he basically sets people up in a room who would normally be extremely conflicted, like a pro-life or a pro-choice person, a very religious person, and an LGBTQI activist, and they agree to talk and listen to each other. It's the most hopeful, heart-soaring, beautiful. It's so courageous of him and them, both people in that space.
Both people, to show up.
And there you see, you know, hope happening, and they're real, these people. They really come from their point of view. But you also see the power of listening. So I'm like, I'm just thinking, I haven't worked it out yet. And I'm like, how do I help facilitate that? Because actually, you're absolutely right. Whether Trump wins, or Biden wins, there's still so much healing to do.
Yeah. And we have a lot of work to do.
What you said earlier. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the last 4 years, I think, for a lot of people has shown them, you know, especially when you're when you've lived on the coast most of your life, the last 4 years have shown a lot of people on the coast a lot of other parts of this country. I think part of the problem is that people of color especially have known that for a long time, right? I have known that there are places when I'm driving across the country that I do not stop. I keep going. Like, I know that, right? We've had the Green Book movie where that was Black travelers helping guide you. Now we have the Southern Law Poverty Center. I think that's the name of it.
Yeah.
And they track hate groups. And so you can kind of get a sense of where you should be. But I think there was a large part of the U.S. that, because they don't have to deal with it, they didn't know. And people of color are like, no, this is not new. We've known this from the beginning. So if anything, that the last 4 years has enabled activism on a larger scale because people have, all of that has been exposed, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
And do you think the Black Lives Matter movement, particularly the protests that happened in the thick of COVID, I mean, all of them were really powerful, but during that time, everything was heightened. And I suppose I wondered, I thought, wow, is that, I hope that some people considered things for the first time, maybe, or more deeply considered things, or perhaps even considered their vote. Do you think it could have had?
Well, I'm with you. I really think that because of the pandemic, it's the first time in probably most of our lifetimes when we haven't had something that other than whatever is in our home to distract us from what's actually happening in the world, right? And the thing that we turn to when we're going for distraction is television and social media. And then all of a sudden we're actually seeing things for the first time and for at least that first 2 weeks, it was the first time that people couldn't get up and just go to work and turn it off and tune it out, right? So if you're of color in this country, you can't tune it out. You've never been able to tune it out. But for those non-racialized people, and many of whom I think weren't aware that they were tuning it out.
Yeah.
You really did, you know, crack open an awareness, and hopefully that awareness will just continue to expand and people will continue to.
Did that make you feel more hopeful that there was a possible shift? Did it feel like there was a bit more of an awakening?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that and just the little things, right? After the first 2 weeks, wasn't there something about people saying you could see the Himalayas for the first, like there was pollution that was going going away. Parts of the ozone was healing, you know, and you're like, wow, just 2 weeks of the world staying home and the environment goes, that's all I needed was to kickstart. Made me think actually that there should be a 2 weeks every year that we all put our butts at home to help the environment.
That's a really good idea. Maybe we should do 2 week lockdowns and also just to like check in on ourselves and be like, okay, how are you progressing with your ethics and how are you treating people and yourself? I like that. Yeah. And then the skies will get blue. Let's make that happen.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Brilliant. So I wanted to, one of the reasons I think amongst all of this sort of politics and what's going to happen and, the climate stuff and social justice and all of it, I feel that artists, even though it feels a bit, creativity feels a bit beleaguered in this country at the moment, not particularly highly valued, but I think the things that artists have, that all human beings have, imagination, creativity, all of that stuff, those feel like really important tools right now, because I feel that we have to have the courage to imagine what might be better than this. In order to even get there, I always think about the Chinese who kind of invented flying, really, because they made the first things that flew. Like, they made kites, and then we all followed them and made other things that flew. And I was thinking, if someone hadn't drawn that, it wouldn't have been made. So you have to imagine things first, right? Which is where we're very practiced at. So having sort of acknowledged that imagination is really important to even travel in the right direction, if I challenged you to imagine a sort of beautiful future, Nafisa, that was utopia or at least utopia-ish, because you know there's always challenges, which we like to, but forget the obstacles, forget about what we'd have to do to get there, what would that look like for you or be like for you in the States?
Utopia
America.
The utopian America. Well, I think I mean there's many pieces to the puzzle. So I think first would be that the arts were fairly funded, meaning that they were given as much attention and love in terms of finance and support as big business, right? As corporations, as churches and stuff like that. So, and when I say the arts, I mean all of the arts. I would say that all detrimental environmental businesses and people who worked in them would be retrained and rehired to build environmentally safe business and processes, right? So, if you were working in coal, then you would be building wind farms or something. I don't know. I'm not sure exactly what the next healthy version is, but something along those lines. Like all of those people would be helped in the transition
just
to
transition.
Work in. You know, our justice system would be overhauled, would be deeply examined and overhauled. And that's the one that I think for me, I don't know how to, well, I don't know how to do any of this necessarily, but the justice system would be overhauled. That would be in my imagination. Our prisons and rehabilitation systems would be completely overhauled from ground up. You know, we would look at immigration differently, and maybe, I don't know, maybe are there no borders? Maybe there are no borders. I don't know. Now I'm going to like meditate on that even more and probably call you back tomorrow and be like, I have more.
That'd be great. You send me a little map. Just drawings. I think it's really lovely to give yourself permission to think about that, I think. And I've learned a lot. Recently, I've been connected with a lot of science fiction writers. And I'm like, thank goodness for them, because they really go there and they work it out. Their models are to do with this, is to sort of connect it to the eradication of fear and a post-scarcity world. So like, we don't have to work, because actually we've got the right. robots have sorted it out, and the Earth's clean, and we can all wander around and learn things and have fun. So I'm sort of
right. But what about the robots? What about the robots that become intelligent and then, you know, become of their own? And so they've become a slave race, right?
Well, I think that's really interesting for all of those kind of writers that explore that, because what it's revealed is that actually you can only get utopia-ish because then there's another problem. But in a way, that's what we like. Mm-hmm. We're probably so we'll have to look at robot rights.
Yeah. I mean, I've been one of my favorite things to listen to is old time science fiction radio shows. So these are radio shows from the 50s, and they're often adaptations of short stories from the little pulp magazines and stuff. And it's really fascinating to listen to what they thought was going to be 1987 and was going to be 1999. And they had a lot of, they predicted a lot of what we're going through.
It's amazing.
And so I look at those sci-fi writers and go, okay, yeah. So I need to watch some more. I need to watch all the Star Treks again, you know.
Yeah. No, this is where I'm at.
Something, right?
And there's great, there's sort of pleasure and serious courage in saying, okay, I'm going to, what do I want then? Because sometimes I think when you're engaged with activism or even a little bit, you can really get into, I don't want, we don't want, which is important, but it feels really important to say what you do want. And given your outlining for your radical reworking of America, for utopian America, if you and I were going to do something this week that we could do,
mm-hmm.
little thing that could take us in the direction of utopian America, what might that be? Mm.
That is a very good question. You know what? We've got to, it has to start with the healing. So I have been reading this book. I keep putting it down and I need to continue to pick it up. I've been reading a book called, I'm going to look it up so I don't mistitle it. 1 second. Okay. It's first part of the title is My Grandmother's Hands.
Mm, I like it already.
I know. Me too. Oh, shoot. Hold on. My Grandmother's Hands. It's My Grandmother's Hands. Oh, shoot. This is a chapter.
Take your time. Yeah.
Oh, here it is. My Grandmother's Hands, Racialized Trauma and the Pathway to Healing. Mm. The Pathway to Mending Our Hearts and Bodies. It is written by a gentleman by the name of Rezma. I'm not even sure if I'm saying his name correctly. Menachem. And just in the very first chapter, I thought it was really for brown people, to be very honest. I was like, okay, this is for people of color and what, but it's actually written for everyone. And he's a licensed therapist and it's looking at healing whatever racial trauma is present, whether you've known it or not. And he talks about how all of that trauma shows up in our bodies.
Wow.
And so that part of healing our heart is about really, really examining how our bodies react to different triggers and different thoughts and to recognizing that and to healing those processes. So I would say to choose some form of healing or seek some form of healing. That would be my thing for this week.
No, I love that. I think that's very wise. And I think we've just had an announcement for a second lockdown. I don't know if you know that. We've just literally.
Oh, no.
So today, oh my gosh, the sort of mental health backlash of that. It was very upsetting today seeing people that are actually really sturdy and resilient just being completely floored by this new news and the implications of what that's going to mean for people for various festivals that are coming, you know, Diwali and then Christmas. Just very upsetting. So I think the healing thing's really important. I think thinking about looking after ourselves feels really important.
Yeah.
Maybe that's even true for President Trump. you know?
Yeah. I think the thing is that we have to want to look at ourselves, right? And it's freaking painful, man. Mm-hmm. Like it's, I can't remember if I had been to Edinburgh when I met you. Had I taken my one woman show to Edinburgh yet? I'm not sure.
I think so.
But I wrote a one woman show that was mostly a drama. I called it a feel good drama. It wasn't a comedy. And I took it to Edinburgh for 10 days and, I'll never forget, maybe like halfway through afterwards, I said, what have I done to myself that I'm performing like all of my traumas in a compact 40 minutes, 45 minutes, like over and over again? And it's painful.
Yeah.
And, you know, our human instinct is to not deal with the pain because we have got to do these other things. Mm. And I think that's another thing that the pandemic has done is made us face some of our own pain, and maybe some of the rage that we're seeing now is the people that really did not want to feel that.
No, my friend said something which I thought was really interesting. He said, it's as if we've all been made to go on a wilderness retreat, you know, mm-hmm. where you kind of spend 3 days in a little dugout foxhole in the rain, finding that thing, getting your ego broken and all of that stuff. So it's amazing.
Absolutely.
Times. I love the healing. I'm gonna find that book. Thank you. I love a book tip. It's so great when someone else recommends a book.
Yes.
And you don't
I haven't read it from beginning to end. I've only really just gotten, I think I'm on chapter 3 or 4, but
what a title.
But what I like, it's very guided work, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like you read it and you go away. Like he goes, okay, now do this. Now it's really like, mm-hmm. you know, really guided healing. So
that's brilliant. Yeah. Oh, thank you so much. Well, I hope that when you and I speak again, or we see each other again on Facebook or whatever, that we'll have some good news.
Yes.
But it's really interesting speaking to you, and I'm really grateful for your time. I think it's worth nodding to. There's work to do anyway, so we need to crack on with it.
Mm-hmm.
I promise
there's
you I will.
There's going to be work to do no matter what, yeah.
Thank you so much, Nafisa.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so honored. I feel very lucky to be
with you. If anybody wants to find out about your company or anything about you, what's a good first stop?
Well, probably classicsincolor.com, although I would say my websites are probably the least up to date. So if you're on Instagram, it's just at classicsincolor, and on Facebook at classicsincolor. And those are the ones that stay the most up to date.
Great. Thank you so much. Have a nice evening.
Thank you.
Bye, honey.
Thank you. You too. Get some rest. Good night. Bye.